There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear.
No professor, prophet, journalist has ever announced that in the coming days a social movement will arise. It's always reported later.
There's a man with a gun over there telling me.
You know, an atmosphere of gloom around the globe. People were like, you know, fighting against the older generation, and the older generation was entrenched and nothing seemed to give. It was going to give, but we couldn't see it.
I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, just another somebody desperately seeking a ray of light in darkening times. In this show, we'll examine the life of Tom Hayden, the radical activist who became a California state senator. Hayden still offers us hope with this simple mystery about social movements. They come out of nowhere when needed most. And don't we need one now? Accelerating climate change, peak oil, wars and plunder, a world club of billionaires while starvation grows until nature collapses, towing the financial system down with it. All with hardly a whimper from the common person, a mass movement might be the last chance for regeneration.
And then the movements are groups that appear at first to rise on the fringe. They're like the sun in the early morning. Very few people are up to see the beginning of a social movement. No one ever predicts the beginning of a social movement. Never has, never will. But they emerge because humans all have a need for expression, for dignity, and for some sort of identity. And where they receive a moral injury repeatedly, over and over, some of them will begin to respond. We call that resistance or protest. Some of them will do it because they have to. They see nothing in it for themselves. They believe it's hopeless. Others will join when they think there's a ray of hope. There's back and forth among philosophers about whether you need rising expectations. I don't know. But I'm profoundly moved by people that stand up even when they don't think they have a chance.
I won't kid you. Tom Hayden is popping up all over the place, as too many baby boomers long for the 60s past. He's almost a salesman for big social movements that just aren't happening right now. Has television killed the street? Are we just too comfortable to move? Or maybe, just maybe, the financial and ecological volcano is about to blow like Krakatoa. In July of 2008, Tom Hayden arrived in Vancouver to support students fighting off a mall development at the University of British Columbia. They proposed to restart the 60s group Students for a Democratic Society, the SDS. In Hayden's speech, I heard a new book developing, ideas about how big social movements are born, how they age, and how they die. I've been working on that theme for you for the past 3 months. Then David Barsamian of Alternative Radio came out with Hayden in a program called Movements and Machiavellians. I thought, uh-oh, I've missed out. Here is the finished work. The Alternative Radio piece is excellent. I'll tell you where you can download it online. But no, the Vancouver Hayden talk I recorded was still unique. The development of mass movements is so important to us now. It may be the only thing that can save us from climate change, from economic ruin, from more wars, from social meltdown, or even more fascism. This EcoShock feature on Tom Hayden hopes to sow seeds that bring us all together in the face of ultimate challenges. Tom Hayden is a prolific self-communicator. He's in films, net features, news reports, the alternative media, and has published at least half a dozen books, many about himself. That is partly because, all through his almost 50 years of activism, Hayden has been both an actor and a reporter on the scene. In order to have any focus at all in this quest for social change by the people, I'm sticking to just a few major sources. In addition to the speech I mentioned and recorded on July 3, 2008, I will draw audio clips from the alternative radio feature Movements and Machiavellians, released August 25th, from a couple of short clips from the Pacifica Radio archives, and short Hayden quotes read out by Steve Bowell. I will refer repeatedly to the best written collection of Hayden's work, Writings for a Democratic Society, the Tom Hayden Reader, published by City Lights Books in 2008. In my opinion, this book is required reading for any would-be activist or social reformer. The Tom Hayden Reader is a collection of his writings from the earliest days, like A Letter to the New Young Left in 1961, right through an amazing catalog of causes up to 2008, when Hayden is still active in the anti-torture campaign. This man is sensitive to social dark spots. He is led into the other, where he acts and takes notes, leaving us a written trail of movements. Tom calls himself a participatory witness and an awakened eyewitness to new social movements.
That's typically how these things start. And what's quite unexplainable is how people are willing to start them not knowing what will happen to you, right? They don't say, what's our percentage possibility of success? How soon can we get back to our career? Can I still be an engineer? Somehow, those questions are lifted, but they're very nervous because you can destroy your career, you can destroy your life. But it's almost a spiritual concept. It's some kind of grace or solidarity envelops them, and they go straight into the lion's den and sit down, not knowing what will happen. You have to consider that as an option because things always seem to start that way. And not everything succeeds, of course, but that's what happened. And then it spread.
Here is a short shopping list of battles chronicled in the Tom Hayden Reader alone. The student civil rights movement in the early 60s. The famous left organizing document, the Port Huron Statement, now published separately as a 75-page book. The anti-war movement, where Hayden was an iconic leader along with his wife, film star Jane Fonda. The protests at the 1968 Democratic Convention. Hayden was one of the famous Chicago Eight tried by the authorities for conspiring to disrupt democracy. That trial is now popping up in a stage play and two movies. His historic run for the U.S. Senate and then the California State Senate, where he served many terms as the voice of the environment and social justice. He had a campaign against domestic violence, and then his fight for humane conditions for immigrant farm workers. He had a battle against genetically altered food, and a new look at the root causes of crime and violence, where the injustice was loaded on people of color. Hayden rediscovered his Irish roots, and a whole range of environmental initiatives protecting the ancient forests and endangered species. Later, Tom Hayden became active on climate change as well. He was also a spokesperson for alternatives in foreign policy, especially when it came to places bombed by America and the Middle East and Cuba. Hayden fought for gay rights. He journalized on the Zapatista insurgency in southern Mexico, the World Trade protests, and the populist movements in South America. Of course, he labored against the Iraq War and scolded his country on the shame of imprisonment without trial in Guantanamo and the torture of prisoners.
Mabel Elmore from the World Peace Forum Society. I think your view in terms of the reason for change being a sociological idea of the struggle between power groups versus kind of a Marxist analysis is, here in Vancouver, the Lower Mainland, it's controversial. I guess you've come across it, and also...
Controversial?
Had debate on it. It's
because there's so many Marxists here in Vancouver?
But it's interesting because I think the social movements, Latin America, even in Europe, that are moving change, the peace movement that's being driven forward, has been on that basis, a sociological, I guess what you call it, concept. And the question I have is around movement building. The Lower Mainland, we organized the World Peace Forum, 2006,
right.
Modest goal of world peace and social justice. We brought in 5,000 folks from over 68 countries. We're following it up. We have a conference on November 11th, 90 years after the end of World War I.
Wow.
And
where is that?
It's going to be here in Vancouver. I've got a leaf that you can take a look at. We're called for proposals from activists, academics, and artists to come together. So the issue of movement building, if you could talk a little bit more about that, and building up capacity and Because that's very much what we're undertaking.
Well, I think that there's a, in Marxism, there's a tradition of thinking of the working class being mobilized around the means of production in either the agricultural areas or the factories. But what Marx himself couldn't completely predict was the accommodation by the Machiavellians that led to the middle class, to the recognition of British trade unions, Social Security by Roosevelt, and so on. So I think the constituency for social change is the poor, the working class, the middle class, and we now have to include people of conscience from any class because they count, they get involved. So it's a more, it's a broader concept of who can be involved. And we have a terrible problem in the States of divisions. The left is always divided. It seems like this is a miracle that this meeting is happening, because usually the first thing at a meeting is to split the organization. I was just joking that's first. Argue over the name and 10 people walk out. But then, you know, in the States you have, as we've seen in the Clinton campaign, a very conscious women's constituency, professional, middle, working class, poor. We have, as you've seen in the Obama campaign, a tremendous 15-18% African American constituency, quite mobilized and unified. As we saw also, you have a somewhat divided but rising Latino political constituency. You have a huge environmental constituency that votes the environment and crosses over many lines, and so on. So the other notion from Marxism that I think is problematic besides the narrowness of class is the idea of organizing a party that would be the party of that class. Now, these classes don't agree with each other for very long and will not join the same party. They'll affiliate with the Democratic Party, or they'll be independent, and they'll come together around an issue like end the war in Iraq or Barack Obama for president, and then they fade back to their respective locations. Maybe they've increased their connections and their familiarity with each other, but diversity and division are kind of built into the problem of building a majority movement if you want to do that. So I do think it's not a sociological concept. It's just sociology means understanding the roles that people play, and you can observe it played out, and then you try to figure out, well, if we want to unite everybody to defeat Bush, for example, what do we have to do to quell the differences between us, or allow people to have their differences and still do things together at certain times that will make a difference for everyone? It's almost an art form. It's extremely complicated, but that's what I meant.
Naturally, I've left out a half dozen other crusades and causes Tom Hayden had, including an effort to make peace in Los Angeles by serving as an organizing mediator between warring street gangs from El Salvador. Strange as it sounds, that is where we will begin. Because no matter what struggle Tom Hayden writes about, there is a general quest, a search. How can humans live fairly, without violence? How can we solve the most difficult social problems, ourselves, as humans together? In the Tom Hayden Reader, he writes, "A better way to look at gang violence is through the mirror, as an underclass mimicry of institutional violence, including state, corporate, and entertainment violence. Nation-states, including our own, frequently inflict savage punishment to protect power and preserve reputation." End quote. That's not to mention our violence against nature. Perhaps this is the common theme of Hayden's life, a peaceful struggle against our own violence. His newest general theory is that violence at the highest social levels is directed by small conspiracies of men. He labels them the Machiavellians, after the power-seeking directions given in the book The Prince from the Middle Ages. It appeared in medieval Italy as a guidance for the grabbing and holding of power despite the wishes of the people. These days, Bush and Cheney and the neocons come to mind as Machiavellian archetypes, plotting to dominate the world at all costs. But Hayden defines Machiavellians more subtly as the operators who keep the actual behind-the-scenes owners in power. Here is a clip from David Barsamian's program on alternative radio.
Machiavellians is shorthand for agents of the power structure, that is, lawyers, right, who work in the interstitches between the military and the contractors and the government and the entertainment industry and so on. They are actual operatives and operators. They're not the owners of things. They're more like the doers on behalf of the owners. And their purpose, according to Machiavelli, whose material is still read on our campuses and in the White House, is to preserve the power of the incumbent.
These conspiracies of the few are to be opposed by mass movements from below, says Hayden. We need those movements now, but how were they started? How can we get it going? Again, alternative radio.
And this interaction between movements and Machiavellians goes like this, and I'll put it to you in M's because it's easier to remember. Movements arise among minorities at the margins and move through moments of trial to the mainstream and eventually become majorities. Machiavellians begin by trying to suppress the existence of a movement and then accommodate the movement, and eventually reform occurs. The status quo of the Machiavellians is restabilized and the movement declines.
You can order that alternative radio program, Movements and Machiavellians, as a CD or as an instant download for a reasonable $5. Just Google Movements Hayden Alternative Radio. Hayden is spelled H-A-Y-D-E-N. Our hero walks the tightrope of a rebel who is also a member of government. Hayden admits he is a politician and generally a firm Democrat, although critical of his own party from the left. On alternative radio, Hayden finds...
Barack Obama is both. He is potentially transformative, and he's a centrist. And he's generated a movement for the first time I've seen that's inside a political campaign when we think movements are supposed to be outside the campaigns. But the times being what they are, this has happened. This has happened. And whether he wins or loses, I will bet you that the people in his campaign, the youngsters in particular, will be the foundation of social activism for the next 25 years. I support Obama for the reasons that I think that you by now well understand, but I don't agree with him on issues. I am to his left, if that phrase works. I am more environmental than him. I want to get out of Iraq faster than him. I do not want to go from Iraq into Afghanistan. I do not want to go from Afghanistan into Pakistan. I do not want these things to happen. So it's a quandary. Secondly, I don't believe that the economics of the past 15 years can succeed in securing the middle class and improving the prospects of the working class and people of color. So I think his doctrines on national security and on the economy are conventional doctrines that come from Harvard, University of Chicago, Yale, totally mainstream.
And yet in the Hayden Reader, we also find a deep hostility toward politics and inevitably his own life choices.
The machinery of politics is based on a heartless and hidden debasement of nature. Political scientists speak of the function of politics as the allocation of resources, assuming that nature's bounty is destined to become a gross national product for distribution to the powerful. In this way, the dominant politics of growth rests blindly on the death of nature. Can all this change? Can politics represent ecosystems instead of special interests? Restoration instead of taking? Or does environmentalism have to reject and somehow replace the present political system for its inherent role in causing pollution?
As he approaches his 70s, Hayden still wrestles with reform or revolution.
Whether this reform is enough or not enough is difficult to say, but I would say there's a difference we should draw between a meaningful reform and a meaningless reform. A meaningful reform would have to have at least several components. One would be that it recognizes the humanity of a group that has been previously completely blotted out. Two is it has to create institutional openings for these people that weren't there before, as little as the right to vote or something that's real. And third, there have to be material benefits, a redistribution of power, wealth, jobs, that sort of thing. A meaningless movement, a meaningless reform, is one that is nice sounding, but is designed to take the steam out of the movement and give nothing in return. So we have some people who think all reform is meaningless. I reject that out of hand. And who claim that only revolution is meaningful. My problem with this, after a lifetime of 50 years of being puzzled, is even if I am an impatient revolutionary and I have a concept of what revolution is, in my experience, it generally ends in reform anyway. So we have some people who think all reform is meaningless. I reject that out of hand. And who claim that only revolution is meaningful. My problem with this, after a lifetime of 50 years of being puzzled, is even if I am an impatient revolutionary and I have a concept of what revolution is, in my experience, it generally ends in reform anyway. The revolutionary sets the stage for reforms. And it reforms may be all that we are given if we take them. So to underestimate reform may be to take away the possibility of ever winning anything on behalf of an ideal that can't be realized. Even revolutionary movements that succeed end in reform.
Although Hayden has republished the original 1962 Port Huron statement as a separate book, in my opinion, it is not the best. Tom himself laughs at some of the innocence of the day. He notes the statement itself was not widely used when it came out, but only rediscovered later by reporters and historians trying to find an intellectual forerunner of the many social movements that followed.
The 60s are hard. They're very hard to simplify, but they were global. People don't study why they were global. And they were not coordinated. There was no international communist conspiracy whatsoever, and there was no internet. So how did it happen? That's the first question. The second is, one thing led to another as if there was an electric effect, transmission. How did that happen? I leave it for you, but those are the questions to ponder. The worst explanation is to think that we were good organizers. We were deluded into believing we were good organizers because anything we touched was gold. Mm-hmm. You know, let there be a festival, a human being, let's do this, let's do that. The numbers are absolutely staggering. I mean, you start with three or four people and you get Earth Day 20 million people. Now, within the 20 million, yeah, there were a lot of people organizing on the phone, calling lists, making... But it was just like a few dozen people inside 20 million. The few dozen didn't organize the 20 million. It was there were little environmental groups and there were a lot of people who'd read Rachel Carson, Silent Spring... And a lot of people were backpacking, and a lot of people were Sierra Club, and a lot of people were organic gardeners. And it just occurred to them, because they wanted it to happen, that we should do something for the earth, because we had just seen the photo of the Earth. We're the first generation to ever see what the Earth looked like in a photo. And it was wilder than God. It was just, the picture was unbelievable. And so if somebody said we should do Earth Day, they just gathered a lot of support. And I know for a fact they were thinking 50,000 people, but they got 20 million. So these are really important, worthy questions to ponder and to research. They can't be answered, but why was it global, and why was it so rapid, and why was it so huge, and why did it go away so rapidly, except in memory? I know one answer to why it went away in just in a few words, and I know there's four or five answers. I think it went away because we won. Once the war ended, two presidents were toppled, blacks could vote, students could vote, environment was recognized, Nixon was passing the best environmental laws we've ever had. It naturally subsided. Yes, there were divisions and antagonisms, and yes, there were the FBI trying to round people up, but generally social movements end when they achieve their goals.
The Port Huron statement seems parked in time compared to a later agenda published by his first California campaign for the U.S. Senate. It was a daring move by a young radical at the time. That was 1976, and the essay is called Make the Future Ours, reproduced in Writings for a Democratic Society, the Tom Hayden Reader. Barack Obama and his team could easily draw from Make the Future Ours. The dreams in it are still timely and yet to be realized. It also represents a pivotal turning point in social activism in America. Let me read you a bit from Tom Hayden's introduction to it from the Tom Hayden Reader. After the Vietnam War ended in 1975, about 20 of us who worked together in the anti-war movement held a retreat in Lake Arrowhead, California, to consider what to do with the rest of our lives. We concluded that an opportunity existed to invest ourselves in domestic populism. Some opted for organizing working women, resulting ultimately in the SEIU Local 925 and the ascension of lead organizer Karen Nussbaum to the top post in the AFL-CIO. Others committed themselves to what became Citizen Action, a grassroots campaign on economic issues. I ran for the U.S. Senate in order to build a progressive base in California politics, end quote. Hayden lost his Senate race after being attacked by the Democratic establishment, but his cadre of activists then launched the Campaign for Economic Democracy, electing local officials, defeating a nuclear reactor bid in Sacramento, and working on labeling toxic products. Make the Future Ours was written by this group, including Dick Flax, a former SDS ally. Here are a couple of quotes read out from Make the Future Ours, written in 1976.
The new reality is that we live in a world of limits, but live by rules which require an unlimited world. It is the collision of the rules of expansion with the walls of reality which we are now going through, a collision which will require a new philosophy. I do not believe that the way to block corporate power is by trusting the federal government to take care of us. The history of reform in America tells us that large concentrations of wealth and economic power can stop, distort, or take over a process of reform, especially when that process is directed by politicians and the experts in Washington. The power of wealth can subvert reform by lobbying incessantly, by using crude and subtle bribes, by controlling the regulatory commissions established to control them, by funding lavish media campaigns that distort the purposed effect of reform, and by waging interminable legal battles to block reforms in the courts. And, most fundamentally, the big banks and corporations can defeat reform efforts by slowing down the economic machine, by refusing to invest if they don't like the conditions set on their operations, even though those conditions are legislated by a democratic process and are designed to improve the people's well-being.
Doesn't that sound familiar as Wall Street and Washington collude to empty the treasury of the future? Hayden and his loose group of activists, hardened by arrests, government subversion, and harassment, already knew that a corporate takeover of government led to disastrous consequences. Make the Future Ours describes the beast, and almost all their warnings came true. You're listening to a Radio EcoShock special on Tom Hayden, the birth of social movements. We'll be right back.
What a field day for the heat. 1,000 people in the street, singing songs and a carrying signs. Mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and we'll return to our look at Tom Hayden and the birth of social movements. As the Vietnam War ended, California became a focal point for at least half a dozen social movements. Hayden had some connection with all of them. Recently, as we shall hear, Tom wonders if dropping the focus on militarism was a mistake, from his Vancouver speech.
I want to talk to you about Iraq, Afghanistan, the role of Canada and the United States governments and our social movements, because that's what I do with my life now. I never hoped to do this. I was a civil rights activist. I was a student activist. Every time I try to do something about the malls in my backyard, L.A. City Council, state legislature, there always was another war. This may be familiar to you looking over the border, but by one school of thought, the United States is always at war somewhere. As Lyndon Johnson once said, you can't go to sleep without 100 million people making trouble somewhere. He did say that. Usually more poignant, destructive, visible wars occur at a rapidity that's breathtaking, about every 5 years. So I keep trying to come back to improving the quality of life in my own country. And I keep finding my government straying away from my country, claiming that my country is not safe without 800 military bases, several secret wars, and two or three big ones going on at the same time.
Again, answering a question in Vancouver.
Well, that might have been a tragic decision. We were faced with this dilemma. We had organized around campus student power and around civil rights, right? And through 1964, we didn't expect the Vietnam War to erupt. We thought it would remain an obscure, low-level conflict. Johnson even said that he would not send troops to Southeast Asia, which seemed quite believable at the time. Why would a candidate for office lie? So I was going on to work on poverty issues in Newark, and SDS was divided, and we just decided since we couldn't agree, we would divide. One group wanted to do anti-war demonstrations. I wanted to do community organizing, and so on. So they organized the first one, April 1965. A surprising number of people turned out because Johnson had sent 100,000 troops to our shock into Vietnam right after being elected. And so there was a big turnout. But then here was the question. Should a student-based movement keep trying to be the organizational vanguard or lead of a national peace movement that would go far beyond the campuses? It would be, you know, the military, the churches, the synagogues, the business community, the trade unions, politics. And I just think that we had an inherent uncertainty about whether we were suitable to lead. And also the flip side of that was we believed somebody would lead it anyway. And we would show up for demonstrations and we would concentrate maybe on draft resistance. So that's what happened. Some of the national organizations got taken over by small groups that were good at mobilizing large numbers of people. And then we attended. But except for draft resistance, we didn't get into attempts at overall national anti-Vietnam organizing, thinking that that was not only a student issue. It should be led by others. I'm not sure anything would have come out differently, but I've often thought that that might have been a big mistake.
Like any sane person, Hayden is aware that the global financial panic was driven by American spending on the Iraq War, all on deficit spending. We now know in order to raise this war money, the United States offered mortgages and then inflated the value of this collateral and sold it to foreign investors and banks and fancy instruments. Here is Hayden on Alternative Radio.
It makes no sense. The economy is in the gutter because it was precipitated by the spending on the war, the $3 trillion for the war, that could have gone, as anybody less than a Harvard professor would know. In fact, this is from a Harvard professor. That money could have gone to health care and could have gone to housing and the rest of it. Voters know that. So we need to tie Iraq to the recession, depression, and tie gas prices and oil company profits to the economy and to Iraq. We know that the oil companies, the American oil companies that Saddam kicked out 30 years ago, are back. They're in position to take over the oil. And so it was never a fantasy or conspiracy plot at all. They're there. So it seems to me only the anti-war movement can start this argument that Iraq, crooked contractors, oil companies, unemployment, high price, it's all part of one agenda. It's the outcome of one agenda. And McCain, his chief foreign policy advisor, Randy Shuneman, has been paid to do this to us. He was the paid staffer of the Committee for the Liberation of Iraq in 1999. It got millions of dollars to support the fabrications by Chalabi and the others that invented the threat of weapons of mass destruction. He engineered the war in Iraq. He is also, up to May of this year, the paid lobbyist for the state of Georgia. He is the person that is agitating on behalf of the neoconservatives for the proposition that the Russians are still, they're down but they're not out. We should attack them. We should establish armed states on their border. These are dangerous people. They want to restart the Cold War against Russia inside their war on terrorism. And where does this end? I'll tell you one thing, that it will never end in health care for the American people. You talk about 40 years since the convention. It's 60 years since the same Democratic Party endorsed national health insurance. In those 60 years, every other industrial country has adopted some form of national health insurance. The reason we haven't is that we go to war every 5 years, at least, and nobody else does.
Did you know that Tom Hayden went to war-torn Vietnam years before Jane Fonda? He first made the jump of talking to the enemy, the bombed ones, before she became Hanoi Jane. They began a relationship in 1972, and the unlikely marriage lasted until 1989. Later, Jane married and divorced media mogul Ted Turner. Now she is a devout and fabulously wealthy Christian. Tom Hayden returned to the problem of violence again and again. He recorded his efforts to reduce the carnage of Central American gang violence in Los Angeles in an essay titled, Be Equally Tough on the Causes of Violence. This when Californians passed the Three Strikes and You're Out legislation that overfilled the jails with lifetime sentences. Hayden writes, but psychiatrist James Gilligan, who directed a study of violence at Harvard Medical School, believes that violence is a disease that can be treated. Violence, he believes, arises from an uncontrollable experience of shame. Too many kids are born into zip codes of shame. They lived in a city glutted with guns, drugs, and alcohol. They plan more for their funerals than for their futures. End quote. If Harvard's Gilligan is right, we must wonder at the national level, did the shame of 9/11 lead to the mass murder of Iraqi citizens? Would a sudden realization by people in wealthy nations of the ultimate shame of wrecking the climate actually lead to more homicides at home, more wars abroad, loss of self-respect, is dangerous to all. Yet when we survey the recent financial ruin,
Following a ruinously expensive and unjust war in Iraq, public emotions seem lacking. No protests of trillions wasted on banks and big corporations, of international laws broken, of torture for democracy. Not even Wrecking the Seasons touches us on our remote viewing screens. Tom Hayden discovered this personally. He calls it the famine of feeling. In that essay, Hayden rediscovers his Irish roots. His own family didn't talk about the genocide of the Irish people, which drove so many to North America. Why has this history closed the curtain on planned starvation? Why don't we feel anything? Hayden laments. When the famine is recalled at all, it is usually as the potato famine, which seems to imply an unfortunate agricultural accident beyond human control or responsibility. It is not seen as the intentional thinning and removal of a whole rural population considered surplus by a foreign power. End quote. And if history is repressed in families, will it explode in pain later? Hayden quotes a character from William Kennedy's book, Very Old Bones. That individuals, families, or societies that willfully suppress their history will face a season of reckoning, one certain to arrive obliquely in a dark place at a hostile hour with consequences for the innocent as well as for the conspirators. End quote. When will the repressed dead of Iraq, the ignored victims of climate change, return to haunt the children of arrogance? What will people of the so-called developed countries do after the age of oil, in the age of climate disruption? Will they mourn the loss of species and places, or force themselves to forget? Will we demand or accept socially repressive propaganda to help repress our guilt? The anthem blares, "Citizen, face forward, never back." Tales of starving in the late 1840s Ireland, which Hayden brings back to us, are being reenacted in Africa right now, and soon possibly for a billion people, as climate disrupts food production, disease patterns, and whole economic systems. How do we react? Will we dump the nameless dying in the ditch, as in old Ireland? Others take history as a flame, igniting their passions to try again. Like Robert Kennedy, speaking of the famine, said, "Once we know, we cannot stand aside." American authorities feared Tom Hayden. The Reader contains reprints of FBI memos about him as the government followed him and tried to interfere with Hayden's travels, meetings, and actions. He was originally denied entry into Ireland as some sort of terrorist risk. The result of this inward journey was the 1997 book, Irish Hunger, Personal Reflections on the Legacy of the Famine, edited by Tom Hayden. Even then, 10 years ago, Hayden was already wondering about the curse of history, the parade of generations. Here is a quote. "Each of us carries a legacy of the past that stretches back far before our parents' time. While most therapists and our biographers focus only on our recent parents' effects on us, we carry also the legacies, spirits, traumas, and qualities of our invisible and even unknown ancestors," end quote. Hayden proposes an archaeology of the self, almost after the famous philosopher Michel Foucault. "That made me imagine a green archaeology. Perhaps as we dig down from the computer loft, past the suburban self and the urban immigrant, beyond even old Europe or wherever your roots may be, we may find at the core the natural human, our animal selves, part of the natural world." Hayden claims to have ended his own famine of feeling. He follows the essay with this quote from Irish-Canadian novelist James Urquhart in the novel Away. "And then she saw the world's great leave-takings, invasions and migrations, landscapes torn from beneath the feet of tribes, the Danae pushed out by the Celts eventually smothered by the English, warriors in the night depopulating villages, boatloads of groaning African slaves, lost forests, the children of the mountain on the plain, and the children of the plain adrift on the sea, and all of them mourning for abandoned geographies." That comes from the book Away by Jane Urquhart. Now, as the last of the great forests are cut down, as concrete reaches out to meet asphalt, we are all mourning the lost geography of our natural world. But Tom Hayden is not for mourning. He lives for nonviolent revolution. Social change is not a phrase for him, but his life. It started publicly in his letter to the New Young Left in 1961, quote, they have decided not only to protest, but to seek social transformation as well, and that is revolution. They have decided it is time right now, not in a minute, not after this one more committee meets, not after we have the legal defense and the court costs promised, to give blood and body, if necessary, for social justice.
You see these people, these young people on the street, and this young man advising everyone to stop panicking. That seems sensible. And here come the men who have been lobbing these, I don't even know, these explosives at these protesters, are now marching down the street after the protest.
Hayden writes again, action, involvement, participation all create a kind of evidence that cannot be seen before it occurs.
We're live across from Harriet Island. You're getting by the cops. Right now the cops have us cordoned in against the river, and we are all under arrest as far as... That's what they said. We are all under arrest. I don't know what to say beyond that. There was at least a dozen people tear gassed, including myself. There were numerous concussion grenades thrown, and also rubber bullets fired.
In his environmental period, writing in 1994, Hayden says, "My faith is that the human survival instinct, which forces us to examine our place in the world, is stronger ultimately than the addictive need to cling to obsolete dogmas. We are entering a transitional era with only two possible endings, either a downward spiral of violent human conflict over diminishing resources, or a spiritual redirection of 21st century humanity toward harmony and reciprocity towards each other and the earth. Each of us matters in this unpredictable journey." That's from the essay, The Politics of Nature, in the Tom Hayden Reader. He also writes,
"The world we see is one in which a decadent and super-rich American empire, with its principles of racial superiority, private property, and armed might, is falling apart. We want to join with the new humanity, not support a dying empire."
Well, this begs the question, when history is a river of blood, should we recall the past or just start over? Tom Hayden is a repository of past activism. I would say a fossil, except he's still very much alive. In the Vancouver session, where he came up almost unannounced to help a small group of students in an invisible cause, Hayden did not come across as a California rock star or even the famous man. Rather, I found him relatively humble and still sincere. He interacted with the crowd as someone from the old left, where people listened to each other, where group action was determined by the group. No doubt this ability to listen, to credit others, helped his long career as a California state senator. Lately, Hayden has popped up everywhere. He narrated the Pacifica Archive radio series on the 1960s called The 1968 Revolution Rewind. You can find the whole three-part series with actual recordings from 1968 online. Just Google Pacifica Hayden Rewind. Tom shows up in many small productions lately in the Netflix about the 60s. His character appears in two upcoming films about the 68 conspiracy trial in Chicago. Is Hayden trading on old images like the aging rock stars? I think there's more to him. Tom Hayden is concerned about how history is shaped. He doesn't want to leave the decades of struggle to the TV marketeers, to the editors of a Time Life series or neocon hacks.
Right. And finally, just 6 years ago, they had a sculptor and they designed a plaza in memory of the Haymarket events. And the key to it, according to the sculptor, was to make sure that nothing in the memorial site remembered violence. Instead, they said the way to remember the events was that they led to the eight-hour day. They led to the reform. This was something that the police in Chicago could agree with, because they could say our brothers and sisters in the labor movement achieved the eight-hour day. We're for that. Outside the event were modern-day anarchists who were picketing with signs that said something like, "What happened to us?" In other words, they pacified memory completely by refusing to remember what happened in the place that they were memorializing. And it worked. It got tremendous publicity, and people felt it was really a good thing for the city. They used phrases that you may be familiar with. Let's close that page of our sordid history. Let's move on. Those sort of phrases. That's what I mean by the fight over memory. And so in that sense, in conclusion, I agree very much that that the fight over memory is crucial. It doesn't mean we should live in the past. It doesn't mean we should dwell on it. But we should remember that there were people before us, long before us. Many of them are forgotten. Each forgotten forerunner is a shame, and their names have to be remembered. What they did has to be remembered and sorted out and discussed, so that the living are fortified with the roots of the past, not by being sunk in the past, but by rescuing the past from those who would smother it to death. If you haven't heard enough about the 60s, I have to warn you, it's going to get worse and worse. Because starting in 2010, we'll begin the 50th anniversary of everything that ever happened in the 1960s. And every week there will be a fight over remembering or forgetting, moving on or not forgetting for a minute. For 10 years. And then hopefully, those who have always wanted to make the 60s die anyway will get their wish indirectly, because all of us will die our natural death, and that will be the end of the fight for memory until a next generation. Thanks very much.
Is Hayden talking about the dead only? Is the age of social movements gone, as Robert Jensen fears? Here is Hayden's take.
Brutal question. I don't know. My guess is Iraq.
9/11 Iraq.
My guess is 9/11 Iraq dissipates or rechannels enough energy that the capacity decline, the capacity to actually do it all declines. However, it's not true for Latin America. But for a probable stolen election, Mexico would have a president today who would be renegotiating NAFTA, and the Americans and Canadians would be trying to catch up. Nicaragua, like it or not, has a Sandinista president. Cuba has a communist president. 10 Latin American countries have elected anti-U.S., anti-corporate governments. All of them were under dictatorships. In fact, some of the winners were themselves torture victims. Chile, Brazil. So Latin America has continued the momentum of Seattle, or you could look at it the other way around. The truth is, Seattle was carried on the momentum of Latin America, because it started in Venezuela with the huge riots and killings in the 90s after the prices went up because of free trade policies. So we might be looking in the wrong place to see, you know, what came of Seattle.
A trip to the Amazon with his son, Troy Garrity, again ripped open Hayden's feelings. That became Rainforest Journal, published in the Rolling Stone Environmental Reader in 1992. His inner struggle speaks to my own.
Is harmony with nature an outdated idea in a world of industry and war? The questions and the Amazon experience create in me a vulnerability, a palpable pain in response to nature's agony in the modern world. I can choose between the pain becoming unbearable or numbing myself enough to work on reform.
Forests ripped away left Hayden with nightmare visions that came during the day, even back in California.
I believe the environment has to become more than just another issue. We are living through a period of the greatest ecocide, the greatest era of species extinction since the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. Environmental consciousness needs to be more central in our lives, an ethic about which we are passionate. But how?
That was Steve Bowell reading out a Tom Hayden quote. Hayden also wrote, "The age of species extinction will not be ended soon, and not by mere tinkering with industrial consumer society." For him, only a new vision will do. This vision, Hayden proposes, will not come fully developed from any profit, but from the travails of flawed workers for causes, well, you know, the activist bees in us.
And now, before giving you the details, I bring you a warning. Every one of you listening, tell the world. Tell this to everybody wherever they are.
Writing about the streets of Chicago in 1968, in a 1988 memoir called Reunion, as read by Steve Bowell.
I was convinced we had to lay aside whatever hopes we harbored for respectability, for career, for step-by-step reform. It was time to risk our necks to take democracy back, a time no longer for visionary platforms, but for suffering and physical courage. I told a New York audience that they should come to Chicago prepared to shed their blood.
This clip of Phil Oakes, the 60s protest musician, addressing the Chicago demonstrators outside the 68 Democratic Convention, comes from the Pacifica Radio Retrospective, which also features Tom Hayden as commentator. In that confrontation, the police were called pigs.
First political singer-songwriter Phil Oakes featured on a show with Bob Fass on WBAI from a demonstration in Chicago in August.
The contract is broken. There is no more America as we know it. There's no more taxes. There's no more army. That's all over in your minds, I hope. Time to set off into the new world, which may be jail or maybe the graveyard, but it'll be better than this one. Here's a song I'll dedicate to Mayor Daley. And Hubert Horatio Hogg. Oh, I marched to the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British War. A young land started growing, young blood started flowing, but I ain't marching anymore.
And Hayden asks, almost all through his written record of the struggle, what does it take? When do we begin to see it all not as remote, but as breathing urgency into our beings and meaning, into our ideals? At a young 22 years, Hayden asked,
what has made me so strangely sensitive when my brothers seem so acquiescent? What has made me call insane what the experts call the hard facts of power politics? What has made me feel we are on the threshold of death when others excitedly say we are on the new frontier?
I've only gently touched on one of the most complex social leaders of our time. Tom Hayden extended himself in almost every direction, seeking feeling, action, and justice. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. You can download Tom Hayden, The Birth and Death of Social Movements, as a free MP3 from our website at www.ecoshock.com. I claim no copyright on this work. Pass it on. Use it for social change. You can also get my recordings of Tom Hayden's speech in Vancouver, July 3, 2008, from our website. Look for speeches in our audio on demand menu right on the homepage of ecoshock.org. Thanks for listening, and let's get moving.
It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. 'Cause I don't know what's up there. Beyond the sky, it's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes it will. A long time coming, but I know.